Welcome to A Cult of Personality at acultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to A Cult of Personality podcast, episode number 113, featuring an interview with Philip DeSlip to discuss his research on the life and work of occultist and New Thought luminary William Watker Atkinson. As part of his research, Philip edited and wrote an excellent introduction for The Kybalion, the definitive edition published by Tarcher Penguin in 2011. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and support for A Cult of Personality podcast comes from the generous subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section, as well as those generous listeners from all over the world who clicked the donate button on the occultofpersonality.net website to sponsor this episode. Thanks again to Steve, Michal from Slovakia, Chris, and Neil. Now, in episode number 113, our guest is scholar Philip DeSlip. You can find Philip's website at philipdeslip.com. That's Philip with one L, DeSlippe.com. As part of his extensive research into the life and work of occultist and New Thought luminary William Walker Atkinson, who we'll be focusing on in this recording, Philip edited and released a new definitive version of The Kybalion, which is considered a classic work by many esotericists, and this new edition attributes the work to Atkinson alone. In addition to The Kybalion, Atkinson authored many other books and thereby played a major role in the spread of metaphysics, Eastern philosophy, occultism, and New Thought. Philip, welcome to the show. It's great to speak with you.
Happy to be here.
I'm wondering if you could introduce yourself to the people listening and give us a sense of your background, experience, and your interest in the general subjects.
I guess if I had to lay blame at the feet of anything for getting me interested in the occult and esotericism, it would be the library I had at my elementary school. There was a whole shelf dedicated to the paranormal and all kinds of esoteric subjects. I remember being in third grade and they had a book. I can't imagine a school board approving this at all. They had a book by Thomas G. Aylesworth called Servants of the Devil. It was a survey of witchcraft and Satanism in the elementary school library. And I know myself and a few friends of mine, we kind of devoured every single book on those shelves, sometimes two, three times for each one. But I've always had an interest in esotericism, mysticism. When I was a teenager, I started doing yoga. I did a lot of Zen Buddhist meditation. So I always had an interest in religion and mysticism and spiritual practices. I took some time off between my undergrad at the University of Connecticut and doing graduate studies at the University of Iowa. And a few months before I started the grad program, I made a phone call to Catherine Ironwood, who runs the Lucky Mojo Curio Company up in Northern California. And she's a walking encyclopedia of information. And so we were talking about different things and different subjects I was interested in. And kind of offhand, she mentioned William Walker Atkinson. She mentioned him as someone who wrote dozens and dozens of books, and he did a lot of them under pseudonyms. And she mentioned one of the pseudonyms, Yogi Ramacharaka. And I thought that was very interesting. What is an American lawyer doing writing under this very exotic Hindu name? And so when I arrived for my grad program, I had a lot of access, thanks to the university library and interlibrary loan, to different materials and books and periodicals and microfilm. And so as I was taking courses, I started to become fascinated with both William Walker Atkinson and the detective hunt that was involved in doing research on him. And the more details I found out, the more it kind of encouraged me to go further in the research. And I found myself after a couple of years kind of up to my neck in work on Atkinson. And I made contact with his surviving relatives, and I traveled around the country visiting different archives. And that's what led me to doing a lot of research on the Kabbalion, and what culminated in this definitive edition of the Kabbalion that came out recently.
It's fascinating. Now, would you say at this point in time that, based upon your work thus far, you could be considered maybe the foremost authority on Atkinson?
I would definitely say that, and not through any type of egotism on my part, just as a very matter-of-fact statement of, in tracking down materials on Atkinson, it's a very interesting small world when you focus on a small subject area. You get very acquainted very quickly with the other people in your field, and you know the different archives that are out there and the different researchers that are out there. And I've gone to several archives where no one else has looked at the material, no one else knew the material was there. And in certain aspects of doing the research, such as tracking down Atkinson's descendants, I know that no one else has really gone that far and made contact with certain people or discovered certain things about Atkinson. It's probably my own personality, my own style of research, but I'm very, I try to be as thorough as I can. And so with especially someone like Atkinson, I've made it a point to track down every last bit of information on him and all of the materials that he wrote, which is a very sizable amount. So I feel comfortable in saying that about Atkinson. I think what you see quickly when you start doing some serious research on Atkinson is that a lot of the stuff that is out there on him is kind of like that old parable about the blind men who feel the different parts of the elephant, and they jump to the conclusion to wildly different conclusions that, you know, the elephant's a tree, the elephant's a rope. There are people out there who will make claims about Atkinson, and I think one of the reasons that so many of the claims about him are inaccurate is that people are operating with just a little bit of the picture. You've only read 10 of his books, or you're only aware of two of the magazines that he wrote for. It's very easy to jump to conclusions, not seeing the whole picture of who he was and what he wrote.
So with that, I think it'd be a good point to get into speaking about Atkinson's life and his work.
Atkinson's life could be divided in half. He came to his career as a writer and a teacher of metaphysics almost halfway in the middle of his life. I think that's how the Divine Comedy starts, in the middle of our life's journey. That's what happened with Atkinson. If Atkinson was destined to be anything in his lifetime, it was to be a merchant or a grocer. He was born into a very comfortable middle-class family in Baltimore. He was born a little bit after the beginning of the Civil War. His father ran a grocery store. His father's father ran a grocery store on Fells Point, right on the Chesapeake Bay in Baltimore. And every indication is that Atkinson's family was stable and secure in all senses. They weren't wealthy, but they were very comfortable and they were very secure. The members of Atkinson's family kind of had these small footholds into the city of Baltimore. You know, there was involvement in fire departments, politics. Atkinson's father was part of a local school board. When Atkinson was in his early 20s, several members of his family died in pretty quick succession, culminating with the death of his father. And it seems like around that time, Atkinson was very desperate to establish himself. He didn't have to make money, but he really wanted to find his vocation, find himself. And when his father died, it seemed to kick everything into overdrive. And he was traveling, and he was picking up a job for a few weeks and then trying something else. It also looks like he was desperately trying to find work as a journalist, and he couldn't do that. And he had a nervous breakdown. He left his home in Baltimore. He went to Philadelphia, and he wrote a series of suicide letters to 5 different people saying that he was going to drown himself the next night. And of course, he didn't drown himself, but the notes that he left behind are kind of chilling to read because he seems like someone who was deeply depressed and deeply hopeless. He said many things in these letters that he didn't believe that there was a life after this life. There was no point living. He even used very bleak imagery that there's just kind of darkness and emptiness out there. Of course, he didn't end up killing himself, and he kind of came back home, and he, you know, kept working at different jobs. But a few years after that, around a few years after that, he started reading books on theosophy, and an archivist at the Theosophical Center in Illinois said something very interesting. She said she's never heard of a theosophist who's killed themselves, because if you're immersed in those teachings in that tradition, you believe that you're just going to keep reincarnating no matter what. So you might as well take care of what you need to take care of in this lifetime, or else you'll have to do it again. And I think those initial inquiries into the occult had a profound effect on Atkinson. They, at the very least, opened himself up to the idea of cosmic laws that shaped our lives. There was a life beyond this life, that there were higher purposes to live for. Around his late 20s, he marries. In around 1893, he apprentices under an attorney in Pennsylvania, and that's where Atkinson seems to find his calling. He was jumping from job to job, and it really seems that as an attorney, he found himself. Atkinson was very bright. He was very well-read, and he seemed to do very well in that profession. So he apprenticed under an attorney. He had 2 children. The second lived. The first died relatively young. And then around 1899, Atkinson moves to Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and he starts his own law firm. And he does very well. And his business grows, and he has a great reputation. Later, he would write that the stress of the job was building up as right alongside the success that he was achieving. And towards the end of 1899, he gets word from the attorney that he used to apprentice under that he wanted Atkinson to come back and join him as a partner. And this is very clearly an amazing opportunity for Atkinson. He's kind of the prodigal son coming back home, and he stands to do even better than he did in Johnstown. But when he arrives in Altoona, he has a bizarre turn of fate. His legal credentials are denied. And according to the Bar Association, he has to live in Altoona for 6 months and then retake the bar exam underneath the same people who apparently for no reason denied the transfer of his credentials. And that's when Atkinson seems to have had a second breakdown, kind of a more prolonged nervous breakdown. His friends say that he obsessed over what happened to him. He ends up moving to a suburb of Philadelphia with his wife, with his son, and lives with his sister and brother-in-law and their child, which, as you can imagine, if you're in your late 30s and you've had this big career, that's got to be a very humiliating defeat to kind of have to bunk in with your sister and brother-in-law. And after a few months of working in Philadelphia, Atkinson had another breakdown, and he disappears for 6 weeks. There's no sign of him. His wife doesn't know where he is. Atkinson turns up, and he claims that he has no memory of what happened to him during those 6 weeks. But almost immediately, he picks up and moves to Chicago and begins his second career as a writer. What Atkinson would later say happened is that he merged his interest in occultism. He described himself as an armchair occultist, and merged that with the practice of New Thought. For people who aren't aware of New Thought, a very simple way to describe it is New Thought believed in the power of a person's thought, the power of a person's will, and that your thoughts could change your physical health, and they could change your environment, and they could change the circumstances of your life. And New Thought was very practical and down to earth. And that seemed to be a magical formula for Atkinson, this merging of occult ways of thinking and the practicality of new thought. And once he moved to Chicago, his new life began. And even more than being an attorney, it seems like being a writer was kind of the fate that he was most suited for. And he begins writing for a magazine in Chicago called Suggestion. And after a few months, he's brought on as an associate editor. And then after a few months of being an editor and writing for Suggestion, he's brought on to another magazine, New Thought, as the chief editor. And by that time, Acton is starting to write full-length books. And that began a path for the next 30 years where Atkinson was simultaneously writing books, writing articles for magazines, editing magazines, and lecturing. He was really a kind of a one-person dynamo when it came to New Thought.
What are your own opinions about his disappearance?
I've uncovered research that suggests that he went to Chicago and he studied possibly with, at the time, there were numerous schools of hypnotism. There were very fuzzy boundaries during this time, especially in Chicago, with occult groups, groups that practiced hypnotism, and groups that claimed to be New Thought groups. It looks like Atkinson made some contact with someone in Chicago, because as soon as he reappears in Philadelphia, he immediately goes to Chicago. Atkinson never says what happened to him during those 6 weeks. He had two pieces of writing that are almost pseudo-autobiographical. One was a novel, serialized novel, that he wrote in 1906. And in 1922, he wrote a book called That Something Within, which it's a very bizarre book. The novel that he wrote in 1906 is this account of a person very similar to Atkinson in age and station in life, you know, a middle-aged businessman who's down on his luck and everything's fallen apart. And this businessman meets who I guess you could call a hidden master. You meet someone named Colonel Forbes, who, you know, kind of true to all the tales about hidden masters, Colonel Forbes is, he's Western, but he spent a lot of time in India. He was someone who was very polite, but also very comfortable being in whatever surroundings. And this figure, Colonel Forbes, takes the narrator of this story and basically initiates him over a period of days. And like any bad novels, you know, this was Atkinson's one and only attempt at writing fiction. The characters are pretty much very flimsy mouthpieces for Atkinson's viewpoints and worldview. But it's very curious that in both that serialized novel and in the 1922 book, which retells that same story, that over the course of more than 15 years, Atkinson felt the need to keep telling this story that he held at arm's length from his own autobiography. And things like this always raise numerous questions. You wonder, was there actually a person who Atkinson met during this period of time, who initiated him, who gave him occult wisdom? Was this just a convenient literary device? It's not very sexy to tell people that you read some great ideas in some books and they changed your life. It's much more dramatic to say that you met some mysterious colonel in a boarding house in a major city somewhere. And it's also a story that is told by numerous other people during this time. You know, Paul Foster Case had his own supposed meeting with hidden masters. Theosophists are doing the same thing, and there are plenty other small, more forgotten sects in Chicago during this time that have similar and creation myths about meeting hidden or ascended masters.
Before we talk a little more about Atkinson, I'm just curious if you could perhaps give us a little bit more background on New Thought, its context in the history of American religion and spirituality, and how much it is a forerunner, if not the forerunner, of what we call New Age now.
The more that I was doing research into Atkinson and Atkinson's own take on New Thought, Atkinson seems to not only muddy up the boundaries that a lot of people have created about New Thought, but the more that you look into the circles of people that Atkinson was involved, that also complicates the way that we classify and think about New Thought. In the very basic sense, most people see New Thought as something that existed between hypnotism and mesmerism in the mid-19th century and the best-selling kind of popular positive thinking movements of the early and mid-20th century, somewhere between Phineas Quimby and Norman Vincent Peale. New Thought was there, kind of right at the pivot of the turn of the century. Atkinson himself was involved with groups that practiced hypnotism. Some of them even practiced medical hypnotism, of using hypnotism as an anesthetic or a therapeutic tool. Atkinson also brought a lot of his own interests into New Thought. So it's hard to see Atkinson's own views as New Thought, on New Thought, as being representative of other people's views of New Thought. Atkinson wrote a history of the New Thought movement, and other people in the field howled when they read it and reviewed it. Instead of kind of bowing before the accepted precursors of New Thought, Mary Baker Eddy in Christian Science, and Warren Felt Evans, Phineas Quimby, Atkinson's own take on New Thought was very much out there. He looked at ancient Greek philosophy. He looked at Madame Blavatsky in Theosophy. He looked at Prentice Mulford, a lot of people that others didn't categorize as New Thought. But in Atkinson's view, they comprised what he believed New Thought to be. But he had a very eclectic and individual take on New Thought. One of his articles on what the title was, What New Thought Means to Me, and he says within the first few paragraphs, doesn't matter what you think New Thought is, it's what I think New Thought is, and what I think New Thought is shouldn't influence you in what you think New Thought is. So he was very pragmatic and very idiosyncratic when it came to New Thought.
I'm curious at what point the more, what is, I see as Eastern influences began to emerge through Atkinson's work. It seems like he was practicing various forms of yoga, and I'm curious about his explorations of those practices and philosophies.
Atkinson first started writing about yoga, I believe, in early 1903. And since his career as an author began in late 1900, he's writing about yoga very early in his own career. Today, we have a very standard, singular view of yoga. Whenever you say the word yoga, people will automatically assume a posture-based practice of doing physical exercises, holding poses, usually one pose flowing into another in a series. Yoga was something very different, both in America and in India at the turn of the century. There's a lot of good scholarship that has come out recently, especially Mark Singleton's book, Yoga Body. As recent as the turn of the century, even the 1920s, the idea of yoga was much more up for grabs than it is today. Both in India and here, there wasn't such an emphasis on asanas and physical postures and a type of posture-centered practice. But there was a lot of crossover between New Thought and yoga at the turn of the century, beginning when Swami Vivekananda comes over in 1893 for the World Parliament of Religions. You see that New Thought students are often the ones who host the visiting swamis and yogis that are coming over from India. A lot of the initial students of these teachers from the East are former New Thought students. And I believe that New Thought saw a lot of similarities between their own beliefs and their own interests and the way that yoga was being presented at that time. New Thought believed in affirmations and repeating positive affirmations to yourself. And when they encountered writings on mantra, they immediately assumed that this was a very similar practice and that they worked in the same way. I believe you even have Elizabeth Town, a New Thought author and publisher, in her magazine. She even occasionally refers to positive aphorisms as mantras. A lot of New Thought overlapped with physical culture and kind of the more sanitary and health-centered aspects of progressive movement. So these ideas of stretching your body, taking deep breaths, and even the New Thought people who were vegetarian, they saw a lot in Hinduism and yoga that kind of affirmed their own beliefs. And Atkinson began writing under the pseudonym Yogi Ramacharaka in 1903, and this was a very common thing. You had a lot of other authors in circle, both New Thought authors and occult authors, who would write under Eastern pseudonyms. And that some of the criticism that Atkinson would get after the fact is that he was some sort of American acting as an imposter, pretending to be a Hindu, when in fact he never really makes those claims in his book. He never claims to be a Hindu teacher in his books. He never claims to have studied in India or studied with yogis in his writings. And it's something that a lot of his peers did as well. One of the other reasons why New Thought looked towards yoga and Hinduism, it seems almost comical now, but a lot of the information that would make the press in America about India and yogis were very fantastic tales about magic or miraculous feats. And this was also helped by stage magicians in America who would take advantage of stories, and they would do what was known as a yogi or a swami act, and they would dress up as if they were from India and do mind-reading routines. What a lot of people believed was behind these miraculous acts of yogis and sadhus was hypnotism. That when a yogi would be buried alive for days or weeks at a time, they believed that that was a byproduct of self-hypnosis. And when a yogi would do a miraculous feat in front of a crowd of people, it was explained away as the yogi having the ability to mass hypnotize a group of people into seeing something that wasn't there. So there were all these avenues where hypnotism and New Thought and yoga and the occult crossed over one another. So in some sense, it's very unusual that a New Thought author would write books on yoga but assume this yogic pseudonym, but it also makes a lot of sense. And the few other New Thought authors that dip their foot into yogic waters, many of them are forgotten or their works have gone out of print. So being one of the few that is still in print, still standing, it makes Atkinson seem a lot more unusual and bizarre than he actually was, considering the context.
Could you just give us a scope of his books a little bit? Because I think for us, it may be difficult to grasp the amount of output that he was responsible for, because I think it's pretty extensive.
One of the projects that I'm working on for the biography of Atkinson, it sounds like a simple enough task. I would like to have an appendix of Atkinson's complete bibliography, and it's become a monumental task. Atkinson wrote, by my count, approximately 100 full-length titles, and his writing career was roughly 3 decades. His output slowed down in the last few years of his life. So this is an average of 3 full-length books a year. There was one period of time around 1909, 1910, where, according to my estimations, Atkinson was releasing a full-length title on the average of 1 every 7 weeks.
Wow.
And to add to this, in addition to his writing of books, Atkinson is also writing for magazines. I estimate that he wrote, during those 30 years of his writing career, roughly 700 to 800 magazine articles. And he was also working as an editor for different magazines during this time. So his output is absolutely mind-boggling. And yeah. One of the problems in tracing these writings is that he wrote so much of his work under various pseudonyms. So not only tracking those down, but also trying to definitively establish what he wrote and what he didn't write is a difficult task.
For sure, yeah. Now, how much would you, in your opinion, attribute his output to the actual philosophies and practices that he was writing about? I mean, the effect that this had upon him physically, mentally, psychically, etc.
I think one of the interesting things for someone who wrote so much is that Atkinson was honest in all of his writings. Even the works that he wrote, that he ghostwrote for other people. And it's a very subtle distinction. There were some books that Atkinson wrote under a pseudonym, but then there were other works that he wrote for other people, and it was published under their name, the name of another actual person. But Atkinson is remarkably consistent throughout all of his writings. He's never writing anything just so it will sell. He's always reinforcing the same ideas. And when you start looking at the fine details of his works, he's using the same turns of phrase. He's referencing the same writers, referencing the same lines of poetry, making the same references to scientific discoveries or events in the news. So he's all remarkably consistent, and he's all remarkably sincere throughout his work. He's very personal and very direct. And from what I've read of him, he's never giving any advice that he wouldn't take himself and that he didn't find work for him in his own life. I think this is one of the benefits of him coming into his career as a writer in the middle of his life. He's not starting to write New Thought books at the age of 20. He's, you know, writing closer to 40 after he's had decades of experience working in different businesses and offices, of having a family, of going through so many of the life experiences. So he's very much writing from a place of wisdom and experience throughout his books.
Now, you mentioned the recently published definitive edition of The Kybalion and your work on that. Tell us more about your research and the book and why you felt it was important to publish this.
In my mind, The Kybalion is kind of the high point of Atkinson's career as a writer. It brings together a lot of the ideas that he was working on up until its publication. And then after the publication of The Kybalion, you see that he's still kind of trying to work out those ideas. It's also a book that's been incredibly influential, and it's stayed in print, and it's, more importantly, it's stayed relevant and influential for over a century since its first publication. It's also one of the, hopefully not so much anymore after this edition, but it's also one of the stickiest issues when it comes to researching Atkinson and trying to find some actual fact and reality underneath the myths and stories that are told about him and his work. Would you like me to briefly describe what The Kybalion is?
Yeah, for people who aren't familiar, I think that'd be very useful because it is such a cornerstone text at this point in time.
It appears that Atkinson finished writing The Kybalion in 1907. There are some ads for the book that first appear in late 1907. It's first published in 1908. And The Kybalion is a relatively short book. It's under 200 pages. It's a fairly, I don't want to say it's a fairly quick and easy read, because many people who read The Kybalion come back to it again and again and get new things out of it. But it's a very accessible read. It's not, you don't get bogged down as you're going through it. In the preamble, the introduction to the Kabbalion, Atkinson paints a very romantic, mystic picture of what the Kabbalion is and how it has come to be. He describes the Kabbalion as ancient wisdom that comes from Egypt and the figure of Hermes. And he says that the real Kabbalion was this oral tradition. It was a collection of aphorisms and truths that were whispered from master to disciple, into this tradition that passed from mouth to ear down throughout the ages. So he describes this oral tradition of a Kabbalion, and then he himself titles this work The Kabbalion. The Kabbalion tries to explain the workings of the universe through seven hermetic principles. And briefly, they're the principle of mentalism, the principle of correspondence, the principle of vibration, the principle of polarity, the principle of rhythm, the principle of cause and effect, and the principle of gender. And each of these seven hermetic laws build upon one another, and they're a way that the workings of the universe can be explained and understood. And at the end of the Kabbalion, Atkinson says that the book should be used as a kind of master key, that it's not an end in itself, but it's a way or a lens to view other traditions, that it's a way to go back and look at your own tradition, even says to revisit your bookshelf and understand things in a new way. And I think the Kabbalion success is due to a type of Goldilocks effect. It's not too far in one direction, it's not too far in the other direction, but it strikes this perfect balance. It's not trite, and it doesn't give you simple truths or solutions. It doesn't say, you know, smile your problems away, look on the bright side of things. But it also doesn't bog you down in a very complicated or difficult to access type of system. It's very clear and direct, but at the same time, it's very powerful. And it doesn't tie itself too much to one specific system or one specific culture. It's very open and accessible, and it talks about very general things like the mind and the emotions and the workings of the world.
Yeah, it's certainly a book that I recommend to people who are interested in the subject because, as you said, it is so accessible. And you mentioned the somewhat of a controversy surrounding the authorship because it was published under three initiates. And I just want to be clear that we'll be speaking more about that issue and controversy a little bit more in the membership section. The popularity of the book is really phenomenal, and it does seem to stand apart from Atkinson's other work. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts on why that is, and if there may be any kind of, I don't know if truth is the word, perhaps connection with this idea that it was the mind of Hermes that produced the text somehow.
I think in some ways it's a very unique text in light of Atkinson's total output, but at the same time, it's perfectly in line with all of Atkinson's output. I like to think of it as an athlete who will have a phenomenal game or the best game of their career. In some sense, the most exceptional game of an athlete's life is very different than all their other games, but in another sense, it's almost a matter of all the little things falling in line. And I think that's what happened with the Kabbalion and Atkinson. When you look at all of his works as a whole, you see that he's working through the ideas that will find their home in the Kabbalion for years. Some of his very earliest writings in late 1900, 1901, he's talking about, in some cases, the exact same phrases that will find their way to the Kabbalion. He describes the universe as the all. He works his way through different universal and cosmic laws. He talks about one or two in earlier works. So in some sense, he's building up to the Kabbalion, and he brings his ideas together, in my opinion, in the most accessible and eloquent and lucid way in the Kabbalion. And when you look after the Kabbalion, he's still working on these ideas. He's still talking about the same themes. He's still trying to refine these this idea of universal laws. So it's not completely unique as a work of William Walker Acton, but I think it is exceptional just in the way that it succeeds, in the way that it was executed. And I think that's where a lot of the controversies about its authorship fail, is that when you really look at Atkinson's writings, the Kabbalion reads to the letter as one of his texts. And the reverse of that is the Kabbalion doesn't read like anyone else.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Before we run out of time, I want to make sure that we touch upon some of the other names that Atkinson wrote under and the subjects that were a little different from a lot of his output. For instance, the Magus Incognito, his secret doctrine of the Rosicrucians, and some of that work. What's your impression of that?
Atkinson even mentions this in a lot of his works, where he'll talk about subjects having an esoteric and an exoteric side to them. And throughout a lot of his works, he'll hint at occult teachings or occult ramifications of certain things that he writes about. And then he'll back off and he'll say, this is probably not the time for that. I'll talk about this later. So certain works like The Kabbalion, and he did a series, a very occult-themed series called The Arcane Teachings around 1909. While those appear to be different than the rest of his output, they're clearly ideas that he's always had simmering on the stove while he was doing other things. In Atkinson's worldview, the occult and practical matters always complemented one another. He saw occult teachings as essentially being worthless if you couldn't apply them to your own life. And he also saw practical life as being a series of kind of stumbling in the dark if you weren't aware of the universal and cosmic laws that were at play, whether these were, you know, universal laws in the Kabbalion or in other writings of Atkinson's. If you were unaware of the type of mesmerism and magnetism that were going on in your everyday life and interaction with different people.
Very interesting. I want to just give you an opportunity to share with us some of your final thoughts about your work on Atkinson as it continues, future publications you're looking at doing, and a few words in terms of the overall sort of significance of where Atkinson fits into the corpus of not just New Thought, but all sorts of the entire like metaphysical field of.
A few of the projects that I'm working on now are, I would like to take some of Atkinson's writings that were never published or have seemingly been lost, and they've been out of print for decades, and in some cases over a century. I'd like to bring some of those back into print so that they can be read by people and people who know of Atkinson and would want further work of his, they can access it. The big project that I'm working on is the biography of William Walker Atkinson, and that, of course, is quite an endeavor, considering, as I found, a work on Atkinson kind of necessitates going back to the very lowest level of research and digging up primary resources and tracking down documents. There's very little reliable biographical writings on Atkinson, so in a sense, writing his biography is having to start from scratch and build everything from the ground up. What I'm also hoping to do for the biography is include one appendix that will have a full bibliography of all of Atkinson's writings, including all the pseudonyms that he used, and a second appendix that would be a source guide to William Walker Atkinson. Throughout his writings, he makes mention of other authors and other works. Sometimes these are very direct. He'll name an author by name and name their work specifically and quote it. At other times, he'll just make a quote, and he'll kind of give this very, very mysterious nod of his head and say, as another author has mentioned, or as one philosopher has mentioned. So what I've been trying to do is compile a list of all of these authors and all of the sources for these quotes to make one large source guide for Atkinson, so that in a sense you can almost, it would be like recreating Atkinson's library shelves, that you would be able to at a glance see what he read and what sources that he was pulling from. And as that's being built, it's very interesting, because you see that Atkinson was very intrigued in philosophy, the hard sciences, and also very, very interested in theosophy throughout his entire writing career. And many of the other works that he was exposed to happened through theosophy. And when you kind of trace the thread back, he became interested in certain scientists because they were mentioned in theosophical periodicals.
And I'd also want to, again, plug your book, The Definitive Edition of the Kabbalion. And you wrote a really excellent introduction where I think you made an academic argument that Atkinson is the sole author of the book. And as I said, we'll talk more about that in a few minutes. But it's definitely a book that you can read over and glean new wisdom from in each reading. And I also want to mention, too, the book includes the quote-unquote lost manuscript, The Seven Cosmic Laws. Maybe you could just say a few words about that as well.
Yeah, the Seven Cosmic Laws was the last manuscript that Atkinson wrote right towards the end of his life, and it never found a publisher, and I came across the manuscript after I had made contact with Atkinson's surviving family. And it's very interesting to see, because it primarily is, in some sense, a reworking of the central theme of the volume. The Seven Cosmic Laws is a revisiting of this idea that the universe can be described in a short list of essential laws. And Atkinson is doing this throughout his career as a writer, and you have to wonder, it's like a chicken and egg phenomenon. Was Atkinson inclined to study the law because he was already a student of occultism and this idea of invisible laws that govern the universe? Or did his career as a lawyer kind of prepare him beautifully for his second career as a New Thought author, where he writes again and again about the universal and invisible laws that govern our lives? He very much has a legalistic mind throughout a lot of his writing. In some places, he actually refers to kind of an omnipotent creator as the divine lawgiver. He signs off one of his books by telling his audience, until we meet again, may the law protect you. May you be protected under the law. What I found in researching the biography, Atkinson himself is fascinating from a kind of a literary view, seeing what he wrote and the ideas that he had, but the cast of characters that surrounded him throughout his career as a writer, it's like a rogues gallery of different people. And
could you mention a few of those?
The first person that he worked for, Sidney Weltmer, who was the editor for the medical hypnosis periodical suggestion. He was involved in business speculation in Mexico. He was one of the first people in Chicago to make hockey a popular sport. It was like in the late 1890s. Sidney Flower, who is the editor of New Thought magazine in Chicago, the second magazine that Atkinson wrote for, he was involved in all kinds of Ponzi schemes and mail fraud schemes, and he ended up kind of disappearing for a while, and it looks like he faked his own death, and then he shows back up after World War I in Los Angeles, where he's being arrested for being an anarchist IWW agitator. It's a bizarre cast of characters. The first person in Los Angeles who shares a lecture stage with Atkinson is a former stage magician and palm reader named Alexander MacIver Tyndall. And Tyndall goes from being a stage magician and a palm reader to a New Thought lecturer. He spends the last decade of his life on the spiritualist circuit, kind of blending his stage magic and New Thought lecturing skills, going around from one tiny spiritualist church to another. At one point, Tyndall very publicly takes on a third wife, and his original wife dubs herself the Cosmic Goat, because in her words, this second marriage is proof that the universe is making her eat the garbage of life like a goat would. Just a very fascinating time in the occult and New Thought worlds around the turn of the century. And it seems that Atkinson in many ways was kind of the straight man in this kind of swirling tempest of bizarre, dubious characters.
Yeah, that brings up an interesting concept, because obviously Atkinson strikes me, and obviously you, as sincere in his beliefs and what he's writing about, but to what extent do you think maybe not Atkinson himself, but others who you've just kind of given us a brief survey of, were using this philosophy and these ideas as simply another quick way to scam people?
I think a vast majority, or at least a significant number. I mean, it's difficult from where we're standing now to have an accurate idea of what was going on a century ago. One of the things that struck me the most in researching Atkinson is we're completely unaware of what an immense filtering process is taking place throughout history. How many people fade into obscurity? How many texts are lost? How many things that we don't know about? It's only a very select percentage of people that stay in print and stay in our memory. I know, doing research on Atkinson, that sometimes the difference between a figure having a biography written on them or not rests on something as bizarre as whether or not any family members felt the need to put the papers in a box, or whether they molded away in a garage. Sometimes our idea of history and what existed depends on archives and magazines surviving and books getting into the right hands. But when you go back to newspaper listings, when you get into like the fine details of those times, there are an incredible amount of bogus people and con artists operating under the guise of New Thought or mental science. Sinclair Lewis in Elmer Gantry writes about New Thought, where he says Elmer Gantry kind of fell in love with New Thought because you could say anything and get away with it. You could just promise people money and they would fall for it. It wasn't like being a Methodist minister where other people had read the Bible too. You could just make things up.
Something certainly to keep in mind, even nowadays.
I mean, if you go on the internet, how many promises of quantum technology credit reduction will you come across on the internet?
Oh, yeah. But I think even more dangerous are the more subtle ones as well, because it's somewhat harder to discern.
unfortunately.
And you see this with within the history of the Kabbalion. You see how the ideas of the Kabbalion were taken up by Norman Vincent Peale. And through Norman Vincent Peale, you have a lot of the prosperity gospel. And it's interesting, but it's also disturbing to realize how many people within evangelical churches and within prosperity gospel style churches are practicing what essentially is occultism, while at the same time they would decry Halloween and Harry Potter and any kind of thing that is a occult heresy in their imagination. And these ideas have a very interesting way of filtering down through us. And
well, I've talked to plenty of people who would claim that Christianity itself descended from a paganism, so it comes full circle, I guess.
I think it all points to the importance of, you know, as I found in my research on Atkinson and on the Kabbalion in particular, of how important it is to know the lineage of what you believe in and what you invest your time in. It often seems that the people who are closest to a practice are often the most ignorant about its origins.
That's unfortunately does seem to be the case sometimes. But with research like you're doing, and hopefully that myself and people listening to this show may be doing as well, we'll become more educated in all of these different ideas and modes of expression. So, Philip, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us and your work on Atkinson and trying to give us a brief but thorough survey of his life and his work.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
One thing that I forgot to add, and I don't know if it would be possible to put in, I also wanted to mention one of the more interesting things about Atkinson. It sounds like a bizarre idiosyncrasy of his, but it ended up being very influential on his life and work. His granddaughter told me that Atkinson and his wife really enjoyed moving, which sounds horrible to anyone who's survived a major move and packing everything up. But they really enjoyed living in different places, moving from one city to another. And that had an incredible influence on Atkinson. And also, in turn, it allowed Atkinson to be an incredible influence on many other people. Atkinson bounced back and forth between Chicago and Los Angeles during his 3 decades as a writer. And both Chicago and Southern California were the two major hubs of mysticism and kind of fringe spirituality. So this constant moving back and forth brought Atkinson in contact with this laundry list of prominent New Thought figures and people involved in the occult and esotericism. So what on the surface seems like simply research on Atkinson has ended up being very revealing into a lot of these different side characters, and just following his history to its end has uncovered new information about other New Thought figures like Helen Wilmans, Ernest Holmes, Annie Ricks Millett's, early Hindu missionaries to the United States. So there is that benefit to doing serious research where it can not only uncover light on your subject, but also help illuminate different things around it.
Good point. Thank you for adding that.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, Philip talks about his investigation into the authorship of the Kabbalion. Although originally published under the nom de plume of Three Initiates, Philip contends that this was simply Atkinson alone. Others have claimed that legendary Kabbalist and tarot teacher Paul Foster Case was also involved. We'll delve into Philip's investigation surrounding the authorship of the Kabbalion and the evidence which he presents. The outro music for this episode of A Cult of Personality podcast is graciously provided by Orchid from their amazing album entitled Capricorn, a song called Cosmonaut of Three. I hope you enjoy it, and you can find a link to Orchid's website in the show notes.